minds. Progressive minds.
Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. How are you doing today on this May 30th, 2012? Well, we get to talk about food on this show, my favorite subject, and touch a lot of different subjects related to food, food and health, food and the environment, food and all life on Earth. And I've been reflecting a lot lately on food. Well, I think about food all the time. But I've been realizing how many of us who are talking about the alternative food movement and trying to change the way our food is grown and how it's grown, going from giant agribusiness to encouraging more organic, locally grown farming that is sustainable, I realize that a lot of us that are in this conversation really have a privilege to be able to make choices about our food. There are many people who can't even make choices because either access to food or because of their financial situation. They just eat whatever they can, and that's a problem. We should all have access to affordable, healthy food. And there's a wide range of that. And so what I'm really focusing on lately is aligning myself with other people that are in the alternative food movement. I was exposed to this with a great deal at the Brooklyn Food Conference recently. There were so many different panels, over 175, with people talking about all different kinds of issues when it comes to food. And the thing is, many of us disagree on some of the fine points, and I think it's so important that we align on the broad strokes, the big issues: organic, fresh, locally grown food that supports our communities. And with that, I'm going to introduce my first guest. He's an author, Jim Vanderpoel. He has a new book, Conversations with the Land, and he farms and writes in western Minnesota, a world very different from the one in which he was raised in the 1950s and 60s. The small, diversified farms and tight-knit communities of his youth have been replaced by town jobs and gigantic equipment operating on huge tracts of land. The culture of the agriculture that Jim knew is almost entirely gone, and he wants it back. Through his farming, alternative marketing, writing, and work with sustainable agriculture groups in Minnesota, Jim is making an important contribution toward efforts to resurrect that culture. We're others simply pine for days of yore and lament what has happened. In Conversations with the Land, Jim offers a clear and down-to-earth vision for what each of us can do to return agriculture to something that can do better by the environment, the people who live within it, and even the nation as a whole. Those who are concerned that we have moved too far from the land will find much to think about and draw inspiration from in the pages of this book. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food, Jim.
Well, I'm happy to be with you.
Yeah, I read your book. I enjoyed it. I like, especially in New York City, books that have short chapters, unique essays. So this is a collection of essays. It's very convenient to read on a subway.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, when you're just sitting and you don't have a lot of time, you can get a nugget each time and then get back to it later. So very good. There's a lot of passion in this book and a lot of different emotions, and we might hit on some of them. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was the beauty and the love of the land that you find over the seasons, the change that goes on, how dynamic it all is, how surprising it all is. So there's a number of different essays where you kind of go over different situations like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is it that is so, what's the word I'm looking for? Well, the seasons. Farming is never, ever the same.
No, it's not. And it takes command of your life, basically, when you do it, or when you do it for as long as I've done it. Because the day length constantly changes, and because the work needs to fit the season, and the seasons, in a sense, chase the work so that you get it done when it needs to be done instead of 2 weeks or 2 months too late. There's that constant attention to basically the environment or the world that you're living in. I think of it as a conversation, and that's part of the reason why I use the title I do. It's a conversation, it's a communication with the environment. I'm not exactly sure how to express it more fully than that.
I really like the title, and it's so important to pay attention, and so many of us don't pay attention to most things that pass us by. So that's really an accomplished skill that you've developed, and that unfortunately many of us have lost through the generations.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, one of the things that I try to point out in several of the essays is that it's important for us, I think, whatever we're doing, to live in the place we're living. And that starts with living in our own bodies instead of on television or in the on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to farm to do that, but farming, at least farming the way we do here on this farm, kind of insists on it. And I guess I feel pretty lucky. I'm not sure that with another occupation I would have been led into the kind of approach to my surroundings that I am.
Sure. Well, there's lots of things we could always imagine. Oh, I could have done that, or what would have happened if I made that choice. But you're definitely, you seem very well suited, and I'm for farming.
Yes, I think I am. It's a curse sometimes, of course. Most of the time, it's a blessing. So.
Well, you know, a lot of things in life, a lot of things that people have difficulty in life, any challenge that comes along, we tend to resist. And that makes it so much more of a struggle, no matter what challenge it is resisting. And the feeling that I got with farming was that you understand you're not in control.
Yes, that's right.
You just got to go with whatever comes. Try and be prepared.
Yes. In order to operate a farm or to live on a farm and work on a farm, you need to be pretty steady temperament and pretty strong-minded. But at the same time, you have to admit that everything that you think you've got planned for the day or for the week or for your life, or for this project or the other that has to do with the farm, can be knocked awry and taken apart in an instant just by a change in the weather, by something, in the biology of the plants, animals that you're working with, and by a number of other things, the markets and the financial system, for example.
Now, something that we are not doing, we as a global culture, when we evaluate wealth in the world, we don't really... I don't think the equation has got it down at all, because I just imagine, I'm not a doom and gloom kind of person, but if we had, some horrible crisis that made it really difficult for people in urban areas to access food, it would really, really be serious. And we do not value people who own land and grow food on that land enough. But when if we ever come to a situation where we're out, where, everything falls apart, those that are on the farms with the food are the ones that are going to survive.
Yes, that's right. And if we ever come to a situation where everything falls apart, my hope, and I'm sure probably yours as well, is that it falls apart a little slowly so that we've got time to react to it. Because we have ourselves in a lot of ways in a situation that could be a catastrophe if we're facing a sudden change.
And so we don't value farming enough, or at all in some situations, people don't even realize we need to eat every day. We just
yes.
take food for granted. Many of us do.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're in this situation where we have really given away our choices. We've given away our freedom when it comes to food by allowing giant corporations to take over and do what they will with our food system.
That's right. We have, and it's I guess that's the situation I was talking about just a minute ago, where you know we've put ourselves in a position where a change could be a catastrophe. When you put that kind of control in the hands of so few people, so few powerful people that have a kind of a truncated goal having to do with making lots of money generally, and just under the theory that things are then going to work out, it's almost, we approach food almost like a religious belief, that is, that our modern food system is all automatically going to be able to adjust immediately to whatever changes might be forced upon it, and we're always going to be able to find what we need to lay our hands on the grocery store. And I don't think that's true.
You write in many different essays. There are some continuing themes, but if you were the empire of the world, the emperor, who are in charge of the entire world, you know, I get a feeling for how you might change things. But it's clear we have trouble with the economy. Many people are out of work, and we've created this situation.
Yes.
By taking away jobs, especially on farms, by having these big corporations grow in really unsustainable ways. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, how important it is for kids to grow up in a farming environment and participate. And
I've written in a few places, in a few essays in the book about that subject. Because when you live in a rural area, you're always almost automatically needing to be concerned about the kids, because we're in a situation where we have steadily shrinking populations. Our towns are smaller and smaller each decade. Our schools are needing to consolidate, and the school buses travel more and more miles to get enough kids together to actually operate a school. And we have, in all too many cases, both parents working some miles away from home. Often the kids are not seen to as well as they should be, because the income from the jobs the parents have just really isn't enough, because that's not paid well enough. As a matter of fact, we short as a nation in an area like this, we short our kids because we do not honor what the entire working people do, including farming and a lot of other things as well that make our economy and our society run. So yeah, I've talked about I have one essay in the book entitled "Boys," and it simply is my reflection on what it seems to be to grow up male in this day and age compared to what it was when I grew up some 60 years ago on this farm that I'm operating today. And the difference, as I wrote that essay, the difference became really startling to me. I grew up wanting to demonstrate my value to my elders. And that was economic value, as well as social value, and that I would fit in, and so on. It was a great joy to me. The day came that I could keep up in terms of physical work with my own father, and with my uncles and hired hands and neighbors that got together to do the work. And when I really arrived, at that stage of young male adulthood where I could do that, I could sense acceptance all the way around the circle and of men that were working, that I was working with. And I don't think very many boys have that chance today. I think the closest that we get with it is high school athletics. And of course, that's only a minority of the kids that participate in that. I end that essay by saying something, I believe, if I'm remembering it right, something about girls to the effect that I wasn't speaking of girls because I didn't grow up one, and I wouldn't be able to talk intelligently about it. But I think that, as a general rule, we can only do a good job with our kids by needing them in a lot of ways. One of them is economic. That's important. But needing them socially, needing them in terms of their view of what the world looks like and what they can tell us older ones who have got more experience than they do, but a different perception because we didn't grow up with the same surrounding social furniture that they have. I think we need to need our kids, and I think when we can figure out ways and means of doing that in a real way, that is, I think we'll start having fewer our kids will have fewer problems growing up.
I agree with you 100%. We seem to be doing less and less in this country. So we've shipped so much manufacturing overseas, and even some of the farming that's done with giant agribusiness. I know that we have a lot of illegal aliens and very low paid foreigners that do a lot of the work, mostly because people don't want to do that work, and the pay isn't good enough for that work.
Well, that's it, of course. And when in one of my essays here too, I write about where I think this started, and it's kind of in the 70s when corporations caught on to the fact that that they could benefit at least financially by disrespecting labor, and it's been getting steadily worse ever since. I'm sitting on the phone talking now, just 6 miles south of a dairy that milks 6,000 cows every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and they have built several bunkhouses to house the young men they get from Ecuador and Colombia in order to do that work, and it's not that's the most pleasant livestock kind of work that there is, because it isn't. Being confinement, it's not real attractive work, really, I don't think, for anybody. But the fact of it is that the young folks are here from South America because the farm that gets them in can pay lower wages that way. That's really the entire fact. There would be people in our society, people that have been here for some generations, that were born here, that would take those jobs if they paid 50% more than they do.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is so crazy in terms of where the subsidies go to pay for who benefits and who doesn't, and we pay for so much in our tax dollars that are invisible to us. And if we could take some of that and put it towards paying better salaries for people, it would make such a difference.
You make a wonderful point, and it pops up here and there in my writing, which, by the way, is ongoing. This is a collection of columns, and I write one every month. But you make a wonderful point about that the money that we are spending helping out victims would be better spent organizing an economy that didn't produce so many victims.
Yep.
We don't seem to get that. There doesn't seem to be any political voice for that in our government and our centers of power, and so it just keeps on getting worse and worse. Another thing, I think that shouldn't be ignored, that can't be ignored from my point of view, and I feel very strongly about that, or about this, is that kind of a situation where young men who are not paid enough money and are a long ways away from home are caring for livestock is kind of, in and of itself, not a good situation for the livestock either.
I've heard so many horrific stories about workers that are brought in from other countries, and some of them are treated almost like slaves.
Yes.
And this is in our country, America. But, you know, there are things that we can do, aren't there?
There are.
What can we do, Jim? What can we do?
Well, are you asking me for suggestions?
Yes.
Okay.
Help.
All right. Well, you know, and I think you know what my answer is going to be. If you don't, you will by the time I'm done giving it. And that is that, you know, this whole idea of a small change that I write about in the last essay of the book, which is five or six columns put together, we best change things by changing how we think and changing how we live. And that requires going a little out of our pathway. You know, it maybe requires buying food at a farmer market. Maybe it requires making a link with a farmer for some of the things that you want to buy. Or maybe it requires simply putting pressure on a grocery store or choosing a grocery store that is willing to be pressured to establish better communications between you, the buyer, and the people that are supplying the store. In parts of the world, and I'm talking more, I think, about Europe here, there are postings on the supermarket or on the market walls leading you into understanding who it is that brought the food and what some of the ins and outs of producing it were. There's a place for electronic communications in that. So I think that you know, that's the best place to start, and you can do more than start. You can make up your mind to live your life that way. You can also, if you have access to some space, you can garden. Gardening teaches a lot about what life and about what farming really is. Depending on your neighborhood, you might get in a few backyard chickens, which are a wonderful kind of a project because it teaches you about what really tastes good in an egg, and it may teach you about some of the silly attitudes of some of your neighbors too. You know, depending on your situation. But you know, whatever. I think what it amounts to is paying more attention to what we eat, and if we have the wherewithal to do it, and everybody doesn't, as you pointed out in your lead-in, but if we have the wherewithal to do it, to be willing to pay a bit more for that kind of food.
Well, it's all about a long-term perspective, and that's just something that's unheard of in this country. Everything is short-term. Pay the little least amount you can without thinking of the long-term impact of your purchase and where it comes from.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. You know, we talk in our circles here a lot about three-part goals and double bottom lines and things like that. You know, the double bottom line being not only cash profit, but also that we produce quality. The idea of a profitable farm is not enough by itself, that there has to be a high quality of life connected with it, and that there has to be a community connection connected with it. I guess what I'm saying is that we need to try whatever we can think of to do the best we can to encourage that kind of thinking and planning in the people that we buy from, instead of just the cash profit margin.
There are a number of really critical things that absolutely have to change. And this is my vision. I would love to see all the giant corporations out of food production. I would like to see the return of small farms. I would like to see genetically modified food and seeds disappear, and think foods to be grown organically and for people to get most of their food within a region that's near where they live.
I can't argue with a single item.
And, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, Jim, but I'm a vegan, and I encourage people to eat plant foods, and I know that you're a livestock farmer, and we may not agree on some things, but we definitely can agree on some very, very big concepts, and those are the ones that I just outlined, and they're so important.
I think we can. I agree.
There was one of my favorite essays was in the beginning when you talked about the weatherman and the weatherwomen on television.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Weather reports sound different to a farmer than they do to most people, I think. So
it was funny because I related to it, and I never really thought about it the way you put it.
Yeah, yeah.
Where for us, for most of us, the weather matters on the weekends.
Yes, that's true, and I can see where that comes from. So, yeah.
And I'm here in New York, and I think it's CBS where we get the weather with Lonnie something or other, but he's always, we see him around New York City sometimes riding his bike, and he's on television in his gorgeous suits.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Telling us about the weather, and it's a joke.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. We just have a few more minutes, and let's see. Have you ever experienced or been pressured by some of the giant agribusiness companies when it came to your own business? I mean, I've heard about so many stories about small farmers not being able to compete and sometimes actually being run off the land.
Yeah. The latest version of that is generally or often has to do with Monsanto and their efforts to protect their patented seeds, and they're pretty aggressive in court don't have too much trouble getting their way as far as cooperation out of law enforcement and so on. If they think some farmer has saved seed of theirs, they regard that as patent infringement, and so then they pursue that person in court. So that's kind of the latest version of that.
You know people that have experienced this.
I know of people. I don't have any close friends, and nobody in this community that I know of. What we do have, in kind of a more general way, is anybody that farms organically, and our farmland is certified organic. You worry about GMO drift.
Yep.
Corn is, of course, very promiscuous, and the pollen goes for miles in a wind. And if the pollen drifts from my neighbor's GMO corn to my organic corn, what I'm going to harvest at the end of the year is going to be something less than organic, whether I wanted it that way or not. And so you kind of live in a little anxiety, thinking that at some point, the organic buyers are going to apply another test, and they're going to see that that GMO amount in there, and I'm going to be able or not be able to sell my crop that year. Or maybe it might be possible that I might even be pursued by the company that thinks that that I planted seed, without buying it from them, because I've heard those stories, and I have every reason to believe they're true. So it's not a personal experience as much as a kind of a generalized anxiety about that. Before the GMO controversy grew up over the past two decades, farmers my size have encountered the agribusiness largely through price discrimination, and that has taken place not so much when we sold our products as when we bought our input, when we bought our seeds and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We can't get the volume deals on seeds, so we're paying sometimes a good deal more money for the same seed. Sometimes on livestock particularly, it will happen that if you don't sell enough animals at a time, you're going to take a cut in the price on those as well. I've had that happen to me, so that I've taken 10% less price because I'm bringing in 10 hogs instead of 100. It's those kinds of things that the agribusiness corporations are always there. They kind of make the playing field in terms of our finances and our economy, and it's kind of always a worry. Sometimes it really reaches out and hits you, but most of the time you're just kind of living with that generalized worry.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me on It's All About Food, Jim. And I hope you don't worry too much. Have some peace in your life.
Yes, so do I.
Yeah, enjoy your farm and your family. And thanks for writing Conversations with the Land. I really enjoyed reading it.
Okay.
Thank
you. Thanks for having me on.
I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And We're going to take a quick break, and in a minute we'll be back with Jason Doss, Super Vegan. Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass. We're back. You're listening to It's All About Food. Oh, yes, I can relax now. We're going to be talking about fun vegan things with Jason Doss, who is the co-founder of Super Vegan. He's responsible for most of the design and front-end code of the site, supervegan.com, and more than a little of the content. Along with Deborah Diamant, Jason is a co-founder and co-organizer of Vegan Drinks. He's a freelance web developer and artist in various capacities, and you can keep tabs on his various rackets at jasondoss.com. Welcome to It's All About Food, Jason.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for joining me today. So, you know, when I think about the world of vegans, superheroes do come to mind.
Really? Which ones?
Well, I make them up. New
there
ones.
There you go.
The new vegan superheroes that have come to save the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd rather turn that on its head and have it be, all the little people, not the superheroes who are doing it. If we wait for just the heroes to do it, that's not going to save the animals. What we need is for everybody, for the man on the street, as they say, who's looking up at Superman. He's
right.
Got to be vegan.
That reminds me of a musical that I was just participating in a reading for, a new musical called The Masked Zinfandel, and the moral of the story was that this masked superhero was really just some guy.
There you go. Be your own hero.
Be your own hero.
For someone else to save the world.
Right on. That's the ongoing message. Okay, so you started this super vegan thing about 6 years ago?
That's right. Yeah, almost exactly. We launched, and it was sometime in May. I forget the exact birthday. And it's been an interesting road. We've gone through a lot of permutations, and we're going through more now, which I won't talk about too much because announcing things that haven't happened yet has a bad habit of making them not happen exactly how you announced. But, Super Vegan has been a leading online resource for vegan information, and especially for New York City. We've done a big restaurant guide and a lot of blog posts about local events. And it's been great, and it's been really interesting to just watch the vegan web and internet presence change over that time.
Yeah, these last 6 years have been amazing in terms of change.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing. Which, obviously, you've kind of been keeping track of, if you've been...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in a participant to some degree, but also you become a very concerned fly on the wall when you have your own property in a space, of course. So just seeing who else does things well, seeing other sites pop up and then disappear again. One thing I will say for Super Vegan is that we feel like, ancient survivors at this point, which is a strange thing to say about a six-year-old. That's the web for you.
Well, in the web blog world, that's pretty old.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it keeps you busy because here in New York City, the greatest city in the world, we have so many vegan restaurants and events.
We do. And also this has changed a lot over the last 6 years, is the number of non-vegan places that are catering to vegans or are using the word vegan. You know, the word is just out there in a way that it wasn't 6 years ago, definitely wasn't 10 years ago or, of course, longer ago. Just some random place somewhere will have something on the menu marked vegan. That, to me, is a tremendous victory, and I think that's really wonderful. But the word is out there, the concept is out there, and while going to vegan restaurants and supporting vegan businesses is a wonderful thing to do, it's also wonderful to be able to, have vegan options at as many places as possible. As far as the vegan events, I'll pick that one up. And, yeah, we're celebrating another birthday. And actually tomorrow, May 31st, it'll be the fourth anniversary of Vegan Drinks, which is a monthly after-work bar night that we've been doing in New York now for 4 years.
Wow.
And we open sourced the concept and said, you know, take this, run with it, do it in your city. And now over 30 cities around the world have their own vegan drinks events, which is
okay.
Just
so vegan drinks, what does that consist of?
Showing up and drinking, and even that we're pretty loose about. It is held in a bar. You do have to be over 21. That to me is the only weakness of the concept. Is if you're under 21, you can't participate. And I don't feel great about that. But everything else I feel great about. And the idea was that we really started out as copying. There were these other events, Green Drinks and Drinking Liberally, were two events we were aware of where people were concerned about certain kinds of issues could mix and mingle without there being specific programmatic content, without there being a specific, you know, activist hook, without paying any money, without even, in our case, even RSVPing. I mean, you just show up. And you can stay for 15 minutes. You can stay for 3 hours. You can stay at the bar after the event's over, and people sure do. Because we would provide an unstructured space. And also, and I think this is really important for something vegan, that it wouldn't be about food first. It's so common for vegan social events to center around food for plenty of good and obvious reasons. And it was really important to us with vegan drinks that it wouldn't be about that. It would be about meeting people. You know, you go to a meetup dinner and you all sit down around the table and you talk to the three people next to you. Nothing wrong with that. You come to vegan drinks, you get a drink, and you talk to, it could be the three people next to you, but also it's just free movement. You can meet, you know, 80 people, 100 people in a night, and I often have and forget their names, and that's a different problem. But just to have this big open-ended event where anything could happen, and the only hook was everybody here is either vegan or interested and supportive of veganism.
Now, what about the drinks itself? Because there are some drinks out there that aren't vegan.
That's for sure, yeah.
That's a detail, though.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to throw a quick aside shout-out to the Pine Box Rock Shop, which is the only explicitly vegan bar in New York City. They're great. We actually hosted last month's vegan drinks event there. They're out in Bushwick. So definitely, they have got a lot of amazing cocktails and everything. But there you can go, and you can just order anything because they've checked it out for you, and they make their own, even the really obvious stuff. Like they make an imitation of Bailey's Irish Cream and stuff like that. And you know, of course, yes, the Bloody Marys don't have the Worcestershire sauce is vegan. You know, stuff that in the normal bar you would never assume. But they also, you know, will check out that the wine and beer is vegan, and that's something that, you know, we try to do for the bars where we have vegan drinks is provide a list of, you know, based on here's the kinds of beer they have on tap, here's the ones that are vegan or not. At this point, I mean, most American beers are vegan, and even a lot of foreign beers available here are. Actually, sometimes more of a problem with organic ones, unfortunately, but wine is a hairier thing. You know, most bars don't have that great a wine selection anyway, so if anybody doesn't know, if you do drink alcohol and you care about your drinks being vegan, Barnivore.com is the ultimate resource, and Barnivore is really, really a wonderful site, and that's where we check it out. So, you know, we do some due diligence, but mostly it's up to people, and, you know, we're not, we don't care what you drink in the sense that people could come to vegan drinks and drink something non-vegan, and we're not policing that. Well, also, many people come and don't drink alcohol, although it is held in a alcohol-serving environment. There are plenty of, you know, straight-edge people, teetotalers, et cetera, who show up and have a great time.
Is there anything special about this four-year anniversary event?
We're going to have some cake. Well, I just did the biggest mistake you can do when organizing a vegan event is say there'll be food. We will have some birthday cake that Verite Caterers, great caterers here in New York City, are hooking us up with. You know, there'll be a celebratory atmosphere, but that's kind of true of every vegan drink. So, you know, mostly we're just really proud that we've pulled this off for this long, that it's still going strong, that it's not boring, that people still want to come out.
Yeah.
It's grown as an event. I mean, it's really, we used to worry, oh, we have enough people, and now we always have plenty of people, which is wonderful.
Okay, so you said there are some things you can talk about, but can you tell me where you'd like Super Vegan to go? Is it just going to continue being an event spot and reviews of restaurants?
You know, that's certainly not going away. And actually, a technical problem we've had for the history I won't get into, but basically we had problems with our user accounts and people actually haven't been able to leave restaurant reviews for rather too long now. So just some obvious fixing. This is the other thing with, you know, building a website 6 years ago on a shaky technological foundation. There's, you know, it's a legacy problem. If you were starting fresh today, you would be starting with better tools.
Right.
That's just a problem of a lot of online applications and communities have. So the most obvious things are just fixing things like that are broken. But bigger, better, stronger, more modern, more useful, more information. I don't think there's anything that's going to totally shock anyone. So use your imagination.
Right.
It's going to be what it should be.
And what's your story? When did you start doing this vegan thing?
Sure, that's a good question. I was almost vegan for many years before I, became, actually said I'm vegan and stopped.
And, almost vegan is a pretty good thing.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the only problem with almost vegans is if you go around saying you're vegan and then doing things that aren't vegan, that I really do think that does mess it up for other people. So before I was 100%, I never claimed I was. And I would encourage others to do the same. You know, for me, it was somebody brought brownies to work. Well, yeah, I'm going to eat a free brownie, sure. Mm-hmm. Not a vegan thing to do. You're lost in an airport somewhere, and the only food you can get isn't vegan, and you're willing to eat it. Great, but then please don't go around claiming you're vegan. So I didn't, and this went on for a long time. And at some point, I realized I know veganism is a good idea. I know I believe in it, but just apparently not ready to commit to it. I honestly waited till the path of least resistance arrived. I was working in a vegan office. I was living with a vegan girlfriend. I mean, it was sort of, it was really only if I ended up in odd situations that I wasn't vegan in the first place. And the same had happened with going vegetarian maybe, 8 years before that. I had been almost vegetarian for so long at a certain point. I was just like, just go with it. Not that big a deal, and I would encourage the gradual approach for everyone. I mean, I think if you do any major lifestyle change overnight or cold turkey, you're going to have a lot more trouble with it, and you probably won't feel it as deeply, so you'll have an easier time turning around on it.
Right. Oh, I like to say that in the real world, none of us are truly, truly vegan because there are so many animal products and so many different things, it's just impossible to avoid being exposed to them in one way or another. You fly JetBlue and you're sitting on leather seats and use different plastic containers, and they may have some animal derivative in them, and it's really impossible to know.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it's impossible. I mean, you can do whatever diligence you can. It's when you know something. It's when you know you're spending. To me, veganism is a consumer movement, consumer thing, beginning and end. That's all veganism is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're knowingly purchasing something that contains animal products, especially for a non-essential need, I mean, by that I mean not a, essential medication or something, I mean, then just don't use the word. Find another word.
word.
What I think is really important is not that people are considered vegan, to say I'm vegan, and I'm working through this myself. It's old habits die hard. But that a product be vegan, a menu item be vegan, that a restaurant can say they're vegan, meaning, they don't use animal products in their kitchen, in their business. That to me makes a lot more sense than a person claiming to be vegan and then going, we can poke these holes in it. But, say I only eat a vegan diet, I only buy vegan food, I only buy vegan clothes, and that's pretty different from saying I'm not going to ask that policeman for help because he's wearing leather shoes, or I'm going to stop paying taxes because the government spends money on non-vegan things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all going to have degrees of what matters to us. I have trouble watching, going to a movie, even if I've heard good things about it, if I know an animal is killed live on screen. unfortunately happens in some good movies.
Yep.
On the flip side, I've seen plenty of movies where I'm sure everybody's eating meat, you know, in the catering truck.
Yep.
And, you know, this is about my comfort level with things. It's not about saving lives.
Yeah, well, I don't like watching a lot of movies where there's just a lot of reckless violence just for gratuitous violence.
Oh, I mean genuine, the animal is killed on screen. I don't mean simulated. You know, I, and you know, unfortunately, it's just something too. You know, it definitely. There are movies out there where that's the case. I mean, movie Old Boy is out there. It's like I really want to see it, but he eats a live octopus. What am I going to do? I haven't seen it, even though I think I'd love everything else about the movie. Whereas I'm sure I've watched plenty of movies where somebody is eating octopus, but it's already dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do we do with this? Does it matter? No. Well, it's kind of a distraction. What really matters is you know, affecting larger change to especially towards industrial animal agriculture.
Okay, I want to know something. You mentioned vegan clothes. Where does a hip guy get good clothing that's vegan?
Well, look, the hard part is shoes.
Yeah.
You know, everything else. At this day and age, you can get a non-wool suit, no problem. You can. Belts and shoes, in fact. You know, I think if you go with all fabric, that's really not an appropriate look. And the fake leathers are just not up there in terms of quality, in most cases. I also have really problem feet. So basically I have two pairs of nice shoes, shiny black ones and some Swedish ones. They're both Novakas brands. Neither of them are comfortable, but when I've got the wedding or the funeral or the right kind of work event where it's just you need to do it, I'm happy to wear them because I wear them infrequently. They'll last a long time. I think it's tough. It's kind of like the mock meat argument is, well, you're going to feel left out if you can't have something that looks like a hot dog at the barbecue, and a lot of us would.
Mm-hmm.
We enjoy everything about that except the fact that the animal products involved. So, you know, you want shoes that are modeled on leather shoes, but especially for menswear, there's just such a tiny selection. And if you have problem feet like I do, I mean, that rules out 80% of what's left just because they won't work with my feet problems. So, that's something where I welcome more and more vegan options.
It'll come. It's just going to take time. There's certainly a lot for women, but just the men thing hasn't come up to speed.
Exactly. You know, and the other thing I want to say about clothes in general, and this isn't just limited to the leather analogs, is, you know, the environmental and the labor costs of where so much of our clothing comes from, it's just atrocious. And this is not, you know, it's not a vegan issue in that they're animal products directly, but really, buying new clothing at the rate that most people do in New York, in the U.S., in most of the first world is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't use these things till they're used up. I mean, you know, it's like food waste, but even worse. So really, you know, buying used clothing if you can, wearing what you have, not buying something unless you think you'll really get a lot of use out of it, and buying well-made things. And, you know, if it can be made from sustainably grown plants. And, it, you know, on the opposite extreme, like PVC is vegan, but it's, you know, the worst thing you can do for the planet otherwise. So this is where clothing is an area where, you know, when you look at the sweatshop labor, it's like, including a lot of fancy clothes, and I mean, certainly all the cheap ones, but a lot of fancy ones, too, are coming from a horrible place. And that often ties into the same reasons we're vegan.
That's
so,
right.
Clothes are tough.
Make your own.
Well, but even then, where's your thread coming from? Coming from? And this is where, you know, the only true vegans are if you're living in a hermetically sealed cave somewhere. I mean, it's,
believe it's going to get better.
We do. And I think really what it does come down to is, it's just, you know, there's these big obvious things that we can work on, and chasing the minutia and the marginalia is a losing game for everyone.
I want to talk about your artwork for a moment.
Sure.
So you can go to jasondoss.com and see a lot of the things that you're working on, and you're very talented.
Thank you, but you know, it's all it's practice, 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 like anything.
Right. Practice, practice, practice. Yes. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is when you're working in, I'm not really sure what all the mediums are that you're working in here, but I know that some of the art materials aren't vegan. What do you do there?
Yeah. No, I'm glad you asked about that. And this is another area where there's just not a lot of material. I mean, if mm-hmm. you're concerned about, you know, something I would love to do is have an equivalent of Barnabor, but for vegan art supplies, you know, instead of alcoholic drinks. There's not an easy or obvious resource. It's not something that the art supply community as a whole cares very much about.
Nope.
And it's also something where you maybe don't know what's really in something. I mean,
the paints don't come with real ingredients.
Labels. We have ingredients labels for food, but, you know, and paint actually they kind of do, but, I mean, the way a paper is made, mm-hmm. A lot of watercolor paper is sized with gelatin, but I discovered recently that, in fact, it's often synthetic gelatin. I mean, stuff like that. It's like you don't even know what it means.
Right.
The most obvious low-hanging fruit is, okay, yeah, stay away from buying feathers for your art. Stay away from, you know, buying leather. And people do these things, and, okay, those are easy. Brushes are a tough one where generally the most, what are considered the best paintbrushes or, well, any kind of brushes, are made with animal hair.
Yeah.
And that goes from the coarse ones with the hog bristles or whatever to the very fine sable. I mean, if you wouldn't wear a fur coat, why would you use a fur brush? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't use either. And the good part is I don't know what I'm missing out on. It's not like I used stable brushes for years and then tried to switch to synthetic, but by the time I was invested enough in my art and had enough money to have my pick of brushes, I mean, I would have only wanted the synthetic ones anyway. The good thing is that I think synthetic brushes are getting better. I think, I don't know if it's driven by the same ethical dimensions of you know,
no,
veganism
it's just
per
probably
se.
But cheap.
Yeah, exactly. It's mm-hmm. cost. It's reliability too. I mean, as with any natural product, you can't necessarily guarantee that the consistency. So, I mean, this is the same with industrial produced food, vegan or otherwise. They can get that consistency. So, supply, you know, manufacturers like that. Many types of glue are not vegan. I mean, this is something with a stringed instrument. I play guitar and cello, and you know, it's, are those actually made with, I can avoid the ones with mother of pearl inlays, I guess, but, you know, is the
I know
vegan?
There's the drum skin on them and the strings.
Yeah, drum skins are a big one. I mean, strings are almost always synthetic at this point. Drum heads.
The violin,
you know,
bow.
Violin with hair, exactly. And I wish I could remember their name. I might try to Google it right now. That was a big one. I'm literally Googling now because I want to give them a shout out now.
Yeah.
Vegan bow. Basically, there's a company. They're down in Kentucky or something. Who make these very non-traditional, but to me, excellent bows. I can't find it. I know PETA gave them an award a few years ago. So. And they didn't come at it from a vegan perspective. I think they had a plastic factory or something. I mean, they realized they could make these quality bows and people would like them. And, of course, they're happy about the vegan market, but that's not why they went into it.
It just makes you think we're surrounded by so many different products, and we really are privileged to have access to so many different things. But then, you know, we need to pay attention and know where these things come from and think about what they're made of and just everything.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's it. I mean, even if you're not, for whatever reasons, interested in being vegan or ready to be vegan, just paying attention
to
where your consumables come from. And that's not something that comes natural to a lot of people. You know, same with labor conditions, with the environmental footprint of what you're buying. And thinking about the wider picture, you know, it's like people will say, oh, this is a handmade, you know, shirt, I bought it on Etsy. It's like, well, where'd the fabric come from? Where'd the thread come from?
Well,
and they're not ready to think about that.
We've come to the end of our show, Jason. so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and thank you for all you're doing with Super Vegan, and have a great vegan drinks event, and have a great day.